My guest at this time is Patrick Semmons. He's the Vice President for Public Information at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. We've asked him to join us to discuss another major setback for organized labor as workers at a Nissan plant in Mississippi overwhelmingly voted not to unionize with the United Auto Workers last week. So why is the allure of the unions fading, and what can we expect going forward? And Patrick, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Pretty big group of people voting here. The vote was 2,244 to 1,307, so a lopsided win in favor of not unionizing. Obviously, Nissan happy about this. Part of their statement reads, "With this vote, the voice of Nissan employees has been heard. They have rejected the UAW and chosen to self-represent, continuing the direct relationship they enjoy with the company. Our expectation is that the UAW will respect and abide by their decision and cease their efforts to divide our Nissan family." More on that in just a moment with the UAW's response. But ultimately, why do you think we saw such an overwhelming vote in favor of not unionizing here?
Well, there's obviously a lot of factors, but I think primarily, I don't know that the UAW ever made a case for why joining the union and having the union have monopoly control over all these workers' situation and their contract and everything else was a good deal for the workers in Mississippi. It was very clear why the UAW, from an organizational standpoint, wanted a victory in the South in a right-to-work state to show that they can organize a plant, that it wasn't part of the traditional Big Three. But the fact that that's, in the institutional interest of the UAW from their headquarters in Detroit, doesn't do much for workers in Canton, Mississippi, where they see these jobs as far better than any of the other options in their community.
Well, let's talk about the direct relationship that Nissan was talking about, because ultimately that is more of an option in a right-to-work state, and that is an issue that you work on, is to get states in a right-to-work situation where people either have the right to unionize, but they have the right not to unionize, as we saw here in Mississippi. How has that freedom impacted these decisions, in addition to the fact of giving people a choice? What have people seen in the direct relationships that they find better, perhaps, than working through a union?
Well, clearly, I mean, a union, what happens if this vote had gone the other way? The UAW would have been installed as the monopoly bargaining representative. That means they represent every single worker, not just those who voted yes, but all of them, including those who don't want anything to do with the union, think they'd be better off representing themselves. And so basically, what these workers rejected was that monopoly. In non-right-to-work states, in addition to having that monopoly power over the workers who don't want the union, they actually get to force them to pay. So it's even worse in those states. But, so even in a state like Mississippi, though, a worker's freedom is being taken away, where they're told you can no longer go into your boss and say, hey, maybe I have an idea for how to make things work better. Or here's a problem I have and I'd want to work to find a solution. Instead, you have to go through the union as an intermediary between the worker and management. And, as we've seen, the UAW represented auto plants and jobs be lost. This is a union that's lost 3/4 of its membership in the last 4 decades. I think these workers are going, why do we want to bring in this intermediary when they have no proven track record of keeping jobs? And meanwhile, we have good jobs that we have by working directly with Nissan here.
You talked about its plummeting enrollment in the UAW. How much of that is due to additional options like the right to work, and how much of it is simply due to the decline of the auto industry?
Well, I think it's not the decline of the auto industry, because in a way we have two separate auto industries. I mean, when people, a lot of times they think about the Big Three, the traditional American-based automakers, and there has been a lot of decline there in the last couple years. And there's, of course, a lot of reasons for that. But certainly the one-size-fits-all union contracts have not helped that situation. We've seen a lot of plants close. But meanwhile, in the right-to-work states, we've seen a booming auto industry. Toyota, Honda, obviously Nissan, Volkswagen, all these, you know, foreign-based automakers are creating, you know, massive investment and thousands and tens of thousands of jobs in right-to-work states. And part of that is they know that, you know, workers in right-to-work states can't be forced to pay money to a union, and that it doesn't change totally the situation for how the UAW gets in or out, but it maybe changes the incentives a little bit. It makes it a little less likely that they're going to organize these workers, because they know that ultimately, even if they get in, the workers can cut off the financial support. And it, you know, these organizing campaigns are very expensive. We know the UAW spent millions of dollars in Chattanooga and Volkswagen in their failed bid to unionize the Volkswagen plant there. We don't know exactly how much they spent in Nissan, but I would not be surprised if it's seven figures. They've been working there for years. You know, they flew down Bernie Sanders and Danny Glover just in the past couple of weeks. So this is an all-out full-court press, but obviously they didn't make the case to the workers who ultimately voted against the UAW.
Well, we promised the flip side to the vote, and here is the flip side, courtesy of the Washington Examiner. The UAW blamed company opposition for the defeat. Quote, the result of the election was a setback for these workers, the UAW, and working Americans everywhere, but in no way should it be considered a defeat, said UAW President Dennis Williams. Quote, perhaps recognizing they couldn't keep their workers from joining our union based on the facts, Nissan and its anti-worker allies ran a vicious campaign against its own workforce that was comprised of intense scare tactics, misinformation, and intimidation. The story goes on to say the National Labor Relations Board, the main federal labor law enforcement agency, filed an unfair labor practices complaint against the company last week, acting on allegations by the union, which was acting on behalf of six workers. So what do you know about that, and what should we make of that complaint?
Well, you know, when you take it with a grain of salt, of course, because that's is a very preliminary stage. Nothing sort of has been fully determined. And these types of charges, particularly in cases where the union thinks they may lose or they're likely to lose, we often see this because it gives them an opportunity to at least try and have a do-over election. So whether that happens or not, we'll see. There's obviously the National Labor Relations Board has a process and they go through these things. But I do think we've seen from the UAW and organized labor as a whole, you know, their view of a, quote, fair election when it comes to these situations is basically a one-sided view. They say, well, the company shouldn't be able to tell these people. And just to give an example, in nearby to Mississippi, National Right to Work Foundation staff attorneys represented some workers at a UAW-represented plant in Alabama, and it took them five votes because the UAW kept overturning the vote to actually vote out and remove the UAW. In one case, they even got the vote overturned because a worker from another facility owned by the same company came and told the workers, and this was totally truthful, factual information, that he made more money than the workers under the UAW contract. The UAW went to the National Labor Relations Board, and the National Labor Relations Board said, oh, well, that may have been, you know, taken as a promise that they'd get more money if they voted out the UAW. It doesn't matter that, in fact, it was true, the information that he shared. But that's kind of an example of some of the problems with labor law and how unions frequently use them to basically stifle information that workers receive and then ultimately sometimes to overturn the results of the vote. So it's certainly true that this is not completely over yet, but obviously the margin of victory for those who opposed the UAW in Mississippi, I think, is pretty substantial, and it's certainly going to make it more difficult for union organizers to get this election overturned.
We're talking with Patrick Simmons, Vice President for Public Information at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. And Patrick, two quick questions before we let you go. Obviously, as we've discussed, the enrollment in the UAW, the membership has been down not just over the past few decades, but it's really plummeted just in this century, just in the last 15, 16 years. What do you see as their tactics for making a comeback? What do you think their strategy is?
Well, I think one thing that would be nice is if they embraced freedom and voluntary unionism a little more. If you look at Samuel Gompers, the founder of the AFL-CIO, he actually said, this is a paraphrase, but basically that no lasting gain will come from compulsion. And unfortunately, organized labor as a whole, and the UAW as one of the major unions, has embraced the idea that what they need is more government power to compel workers to be part of the union, to maybe make it easier to organize workers and that sort of thing. And so they focused far too much on getting the government to give them power over workers and over companies instead of actually convincing workers that joining voluntarily would be a good decision for them and that paying dues might actually be a good use of their money. So as long as they continue to rely on government compulsion, I don't think there will be a reversal. But if they can, realign their principles and sort of focus on gaining voluntary membership, then maybe they can reverse some of those declines.
Last topic, what do you want to see? What do you think you might see from this president and this Congress on issues related to the right to work and organized labor and so forth? The media seems to only have about a 2 or 3 story attention span, and so these sorts of issues haven't been in the headlines much, but what's either in the hopper or what would you like to see in the hopper?
Sure. Well, there's a few things that are taking place right now. We just last week confirmed a new member to the National Labor Relations Board. There are now basically two Obama nominees and two, not Trump, but sort of Republican nominees. They basically are selected sort of on a partisan basis. There's one more nominee pending, which will be important because then you'll have a 3-member majority that can begin to overturn some of the many abuses that the Obama National Labor Relations Board engaged in over the past 8 years. So that's one of the important things that we're seeing in Congress, and I believe that vote is going to take place in the Senate when they return from the recess in September. On a bigger picture, I mean, the National Right to Work Act is, of course, the primary federal legislation that the National Right to Work Foundation's sister organization, the National Right to Work Committee, focuses on. During the election, President Trump said he would sign that if it got to his desk. And so it's really a matter of pushing it in the Senate and the House. That may not be easy, but we do know that the right to work is popular. You poll the Americans and you get 80% support for right to work, which, of course, just means that union membership and dues payment are voluntary. It doesn't stop anyone from joining a union, doesn't stop anyone from paying dues. It merely says that they can't be forced to do so. And so obviously a National Right to Work Act would be a wonderful thing, freeing millions of workers from forced union dues.
Patrick, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, sir, very much for your time today.
Certainly. Glad to be with you, Greg.
Patrick Semmons is Vice President for Public Information at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.